very warm welcome. So if you've been coming for a while, you'll know that we are currently in the midst of a theme which we've called rather inelegantly Head, Heart and Guts. So we are looking at the need for total transformation. The Dharma is about transforming all aspects of us, not just giving some sort of intellectual insight. Our thinking, the way we see the world, our feeling, and our volition, what we will. So head, heart, and gut. And as an aspect of that theme, we're looking at a trio of bodhisattvas called the Three Family Protectors, the three protectors of the family of the Buddha, who embody those aspects of enlightenment, embody the wisdom aspect, the feeling aspect of enlightenment, and the energy and strength aspect of enlightenment. So the first of these trio is Manjugosha, who we have a picture of here, who is the bodhisattva of wisdom. Who embodies wisdom? who embodies wisdom and whose sword cuts off all our sort of silly ideas and our mind-forged manacles. So, yeah, we've been looking at Manjugosha and we've been looking at wisdom, the wisdom aspect of enlightenment. And tonight we come to the very end of that aspect of our theme. So tonight we're going to have three short talks. Slightly jokingly, tongue-in-cheek, entitled My Favourite Lakshana. So if you'll remember, the three Lakshanas are anicca, impermanence, transience, the fact that everything changes, the lack of independent self-nature, independent permanent self-nature, and dukkha, unsatisfactoriness, the fact that nothing can give us permanent satisfaction. So they are the three characteristics of conditioned things. That all things are impermanent, that all conditioned things lack independent self-nature, and that no thing can give us permanent satisfaction. So tonight we're going to have three short talks on My Favourite Lakshana. And we're going to start with Lila Matu talking about impermanence. And then we're going to have Daniel talking about anatman, lack of permanent self, lack of self-nature, lack of integral self-nature, independent self-nature. And then Tracy talking about dukkha, about unsatisfactoriness. So first of all, Lila Matu.
There's a lot of people. Am I all switched on? Can you hear it back? Great, good. Okay, so I'm going to start with an image, partly because it's going to help me to breathe, because I'm feeling quite nervous. Look at this number of people here. So, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to pass these round, so that if people want to have a play with this traditional image of impermanence while I'm talking, you're very welcome to. If not, you can just pass them on. But could I ask people to stop at the end of my talk, please? You can play with them again at the interval if you'd like. So I love bubbles, so I really enjoyed that, actually. I've always loved bubbles. I have them on my shrine. In part because my five-year-old son really loves them. And so if he comes up in the morning and needs me in the middle of my meditation, it can get me about 5 minutes of extra meditation time sometimes. But also, I just think I like watching them in themselves. And one of the things that I was thinking about as I was starting to think about impermanence this talk was I was blowing bubbles with my little boy the other day. And I watched all of these little bubbles float to the ground. And I thought about this talk, and I suddenly thought, oh my goodness, from a Buddha's perspective, we're just like those bubbles, actually. That they all float down, some of them maybe pop before others do, but actually, they're all going to pop in a relatively short time in the great scheme of things. And maybe just notice how that thought affects you, whether it makes you shocked or afraid, maybe whether it makes you feel relieved, because I know my experience of coming across the Lakshanas for the first time was just having a sense of relief somehow, that actually maybe I'm not so central and so important to the universe as I think I am. So a very famous Buddhist called Tsongkhapa says, in a similar image, "This life I must know as the tiny splash of a raindrop, a thing of beauty that disappears even as it comes into being. Therefore, I recall my inspiration and aspiration, and I resolve to make use of every day and every night, wherever I am, to realise it." So one of the things I've been reflecting on is that most of the things that I find most beautiful are radically impermanent, so bubbles, or the dewdrops that Tsongkhapa's talking about. Have you ever been out early in the morning, and the raindrops that just sort of seem to be cradled in the little cups that the leaves make, and they look like little jewels, but they're gone by the middle of the day. I also really love watching clouds. So clouds moving across the sky, they're always changing. You can't pin them down, and you'll never get those exact clouds again. So that's just a couple of images for impermanence. So I think impermanence is actually my favorite Lakshana. And it's also very, very central to the Dharma. So the Buddha's last words, just before he reached his parinirvana, before his body died, were, "All conditioned things are impermanent. With mindfulness, strive on." And I do feel like, in a way, impermanence is really obvious at a cognitive level of thinking. You can't really argue with it. At some level, nobody in this room would argue with the fact that they're going to die at some point. That in 100 years' time, this room hopefully will be filled with very different Buddhists, listening to very different people talking about the Dharma. But it's certainly not going to be me, and it's very unlikely that it will be any of us at that point. So we can't argue with it at a head level, but I don't think I really take that on at a heart level or a guts level a lot in my life. So what I'm going to talk about is a couple of times when I feel like I've got a bit closer to really taking that on. I'm going to talk about my experience as a parent of my son growing up, and I'm going to talk about the experience of my mum dying. And I did suddenly have a bit of doubt, thinking, oh my goodness, is this just going to get very sad and very like, I think I probably am a bit prone to focusing on the aspects of impermanence that's about the things that I love. The things I want to be permanent aren't. And so I just wanted to sort of give a reminder as well that there's lots of positive aspects of impermanence. That impermanence means we can all change and we can grow. It means that karma works. It means that if I practice the metta bhavana, I am going to become kinder and less judgmental to myself and to others as the years go by. And that is my lived experience, and I really believe that that is true. If I was a fixed thing and impermanence didn't exist, that wouldn't be possible. So I found the experience of becoming a parent a really good teacher around impermanence. I think it's partly because kids change so quickly. Like, I found myself doing that thing that my aunties and uncles used to do when I was little, of seeing friends' kids and going, oh my goodness, how much you've grown. Because they really do. Like, you see them within 6 weeks, a little child has really changed quickly. And in the couple of months after my son Alex was born, was a very, sort of felt like a very blessed time for me. I was feeling incredibly happy and fulfilled. My life was very demanding, but at the same time it was very simple. And I do remember having this sense of time passing really quickly and really knowing that I wouldn't get these days, these months with him ever again. And one morning when Alex was about 3 months old, I just woke up with this image of myself totally clinging on to, like a slippery rock, trying to get out of this river of impermanence that was trying to carry me along. And I was gripping on and gripping on, and I sort of knew that I'd have to let go eventually, that it was futile. Impermanence was going to do its thing, it was going to take me. And could just see how much energy I was spending with that kind of gripping on. And this is what I wrote in my diary then, so it's called Alex at 3 months. I wake, my whole body grasping at a day not yet begun, or yesterday's memory. Unwilling to let it go into the current of becoming, I cling to the slight stripy sleep suit half your length that used to be too big. I cling to the smell of your downy scalp, a humid human scent against my cheek. I cling to your smile each time I make your nose go beep. How old will you be when this game's outgrown? I cling to this time, this space, this gift, this timeless time when I do not wear a watch. I cling to this full-time work of no work, of giving myself without resentment to what is ultimately worthwhile. Can I let go into this current of becoming? Can I let you go into this current of becoming? So I think impermanence as a parent is a great teacher on just letting go, letting my son develop into who he's going to be and not overly controlling that. And of course, at other times, impermanence has also been a great comfort. So also, I have a repeated memory of lying next to my son, willing him to go back to sleep at about 3 o'clock in the morning. And I'm awake with him for the third time that night, for the third or fourth day in a row, telling myself, trying to keep my temper and act skillfully, telling myself he will go to sleep at some point and so will I. This will not last forever. And at the same time, somehow that then bringing up all the other parents across the city, some of whom I know in this room, who might well be doing the same thing with their young infants at that time, being awake at 3 o'clock in the morning and trying not to lose their temper. And one of the things that impermanence has brought me to do with my son, which I'm trying to do at the moment, is just to try and find a few minutes each day where I try and be really present with him and just watch him when he's playing and notice him the same way I might look at the bubbles or I might look at the dewdrops if I was on a retreat. It's quite hard to find the discipline to do that. I find it very hard turning my phone off. But when I do it, it's just really beautiful, like seeing the sunlight on his hair or seeing how he concentrates as he solves a puzzle. And to seeing him really as he is now, realizing that he's never going to be exactly the same again. So I do think that's my experience, that when I see things with impermanence, it makes me appreciate them more and love them more. So the other experience where I've had where I've sort of had a sense, felt sense of impermanence really strongly was when my mum died, which was about 4 years ago in 2014. And I've always really loved the Parinirvana rituals here. And I remember that one particularly vividly. My mum had just been told and had just told me that her cancer was now terminal. And the doctors had said there was nothing more they could do to slow the progress of it. And she'd probably have between 3 months and a year left to live. And I remember sitting in the puja, I remember exactly where I sat in the shrine room, and looking at the photos on the shrine and suddenly realising that my mum's photo would in all probability be on that shrine the next year. And I just had this really strong thought of, I'm just not equipped for this. I just had no idea how I was going to cope with that year. And I knew it was going to happen anyway, and it did. So I'd had quite a complicated relationship with my mum in some ways, and I had explored it a fair bit before then. But somehow knowing that we only had a few months left in our relationship did more for me than years of doing the metta bhavana or years of doing therapy. A friend of mine said something really radical at the weekend, which really struck me, where she said, love is a decision, not a feeling. And actually, with impermanence snapping at my heels, I feel like I just made that decision just to try and love my mum as best I could. And amazingly, at that point, somehow the complexity and the resentment dropped away. It didn't matter anymore. And what was left was gratitude and love and a lot of grief. So one of the things that I did was, as soon as I knew my mum was dying, I had a strong sense I'd want to rejoice in her at her funeral, the same way as we rejoice in people in Mitra ceremonies, for example, at the Buddhist centre. And I decided I wanted to start making some notes now because I was in a really good place about our relationship at that point, and I was aware that I didn't know how long that would last. And so I started making some notes, writing about her
positive qualities, her generosity, her creativity, etc., etc. And I suddenly had this thought, why am I waiting to say all this until she dies? It just seems so absurd and such a waste of time. And so I turned those rejoicings into a Mother's Day card. I wrote her quite a long letter for Mother's Day, which I gave her. And it just felt like that was something, she really loved it. It felt like I was really putting myself out there as a bit of a risk, but she really loved it. And it felt like it healed something really important between us somehow, that she knew how much I loved her, and that was the only thing that mattered at that point. So, I do think that around the time of my mum's death, the teaching on impermanence did feel like a real comfort in some way, because it basically said that nobody was doing anything wrong. It was like this was just something that was happening, and it happened to me, and it happened to others, and would happen to all of us. And it didn't mean that I wasn't intensely grief-stricken, that I didn't feel it, but it did feel like I have a bit of a map. I didn't feel like ripped off by it somehow. I didn't feel like this shouldn't be happening. In fact, I had this repeated voice in my head, which was just like, there's nothing wrong here, there's nothing wrong here. And I was fortunate in that my mum was quite old, you know, she was, so she was 70, which isn't actually very old at all, but if somehow for me, it sort of fitted with my rules of how impermanent things should be, that she was dying before me, and that seemed somehow a bit of what people talk about as a good innings. And it did strike me at that time that I would have such a different view of the situation if it had been my son and not my mum who had died, and that I'd have a whole different level of things to work with around that. So as well as experiencing waves of grief around my mum's death, I also had a sense of being in a really privileged space, that somehow death is one of those thin places where the veil that lies between how I experience the world and how it actually is much thinner. And I had glimpses of meditation. I was very lucky to go on retreat a couple of times in the 6 months after my mum died. And I had glimpses of seeing reality in a way that I've never had before or since. And finally, it also gave my motivation for Dharma practice a massive boost. I think partly because those glimpses just gave me a real confidence that what the Buddha said was true. But also I had a strong sense of my own impermanence, that I was also, had no idea how long I had left on this earth. And there was just no time to waste in doing stuff that wasn't really important to me. And for me, that meant that I think I really got focused around really wanting to be ordained. But there was a sudden urgency to that, because I don't know how many years I have to practice the Dharma or to help other people create the conditions to do so. So I wanted to end with something that I wrote on the morning of my mum's death, after we'd left the hospital and come home after she'd died. It's called The Call. I learned something today. I learned that when you get the call at 4:15 a.m. from the hospital where your mum lies dying, you don't in fact drive like the wind. You may sweep the exquisite dew-lined cobwebs from your wing mirror with impatient haste, but you will drive slowly with due care and attention through the thick early morning fog, because in this moment you will realise how precious your own life is.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about an Atman or lack of inherent self. And I started by thinking, why is this my favourite Lakshana? And actually, I don't think that's kind of quite right, favourite Lakshana, but it's certainly the one that I find the most mysterious, the most unfathomable, or, you know, the one that captures my interest the most. And I think part of that is because, you know, with the other two, they're a lot more kind of obvious and apparent to me. So impermanence, we see it everywhere. We see it in the seasons. We see it in our emotions, in our mental states. We see it through births and deaths in our lives. And even though we might kind of not grasp the real implications of what that's talking about, you know, it is the water that we swim in a sense. And the same is kind of true of dukkha. Yeah, so we experience dukkha all the time. You might even be experiencing dukkha right now, you know, too hot, too cold, uncomfortable, you know, whatever. Again, it really is kind of the water we swim in. Dukkha will come and find us. But with anatman, so with this idea of us having this lack of inherent self, for me that just didn't seem to match up with what, you know, my experience of things were. You know, if anything, like the one undying great love of my life has been with myself. So this kind of idea that I might not have a fixed or inherent self is like, that just doesn't make sense. And kind of whether we love ourselves or whether we hate ourselves or we're sort of on somewhere on the spectrum in between, we are all obsessed with ourselves. Or we're obsessed with the idea of having a self. So that seems to be really at odds with what this teaching is saying to us. And I think because of this, we need to be a lot more conscientious about how we examine this, about how we look at it in our own experience. You know, inquiring into what exactly this idea of lack of inherent self might mean. So, yeah, what might it mean? What might it mean? I think, you know, if we have this sort of really strong sense of self, then what is an Atman? What is an Atman? I think what it isn't is sort of self-denial. So it's not saying that we don't exist as an entity. That's not quite right. But this idea of an Atman is asking us a set of questions that we need to kind of reflect on in our own experience. So it's asking us to consider, is my sense of self fixed and unchanging? Or is it something else? Is my sense of self separate and unconnected from the world around me? Or is it something else? Is my sense of self always there? Or is it something else? And I think what this teaching on Anatman to me draws my attention to is the possibility that actually this fixed sense of self, this sense of essential me-ness that we have, could be an illusion, a refraction of consciousness, I've heard it say, which I find really poetic. And this kind of illusion can be useful or harmful in equal measures, but either way, it is an illusion. It is ultimately wrong. And our sense of self is also connected to the other two lakshanas. It is impermanent. Yeah, it changes. But also it causes us to suffer because it brings us into conflict with the way things are. So it's really important that, you know, in a way, one of the ultimate wrong views that we come across is this fixed sense of self, or Atman from the Anatman. It's a fixed sense of self. So to liberate ourselves from this suffering, we need to look at that very carefully. So how can we do that? How can we look at this very strange idea of lack of inherent self when it seems so strongly that we have such a fixed and incredibly important self? And, you know, traditionally we might do it through meditation and reflection, you know, gaining insight into the fundamental non-duality of the self. But this sounds, you know, can sound very lofty and unattainable. And actually, kind of what I want to talk about is that we can reflect on an Atman in very everyday ways, in our everyday experience. So I'm just going to talk about three points, three kind of things we can look at, or ways we can look at things, to sort of start seeing what an Atman might mean in our everyday experience. So the first thing I think we need to look at is the conditions that we're in. So asking ourselves, how is my sense of self, or my sense of a fixed self, of who I am, affected by the conditions that I'm in? You know, I think we all have a sense of when we're in different conditions, of having a sort of, like a set of selves, almost, I was thinking of like Russian dolls. We experience ourselves as being different in different situations. So, for example, think of yourself at work, at home, at the Buddhist center. You know, they may feel subtly different, they might feel radically different, but there is some sort of sense of unfixity in what we think of as being myself in these different situations. I think it's really important just to watch ourselves in different conditions to see how things don't always kind of align with each other. So for me, I had a really, really strong experience of this, of seeing how conditions affected my sense of self during a year and a half that I lived in Japan. So when I was a student, I studied for a year and a bit at a university in Japan and had an absolutely excellent time. It was really good. But the experience of living in a radically different set of social and cultural, linguistic conditions was incredibly interesting, because what happened is it sort of showed me how my habitual ways of relating to the world around me, the interface between myself and the conditions of the world, just sort of seemed to break down. And this is a really well-documented phenomenon. So there's this thing called culture shock that people who live in countries like Japan experience when they've been there for quite a period of time. And what can happen with that is that your sense of who you are can start to sort of warp and unravel, because the conditions that you're in that usually bolster this sense of who we are have changed so radically. And that can be extremely uncomfortable. In fact, it can lead to sort of problems with depression and then sleep difficulties and anxiety. And I did find it incredibly difficult as well. But ultimately, even though it was unpleasant to begin with, I found it extremely liberating. So people also talk of coming through this sense of culture shock, because ultimately I could see how actually my sense of who I was had been really fixed and limited by this very particular set of conditions that I lived my life in, and that whilst that was a bit sort of odd seeing it unravel, it was also really liberating, because I could see how I could live under a sort of, I could be more, I could do more, I could see the world in new and beautiful ways. I could sort of liberate myself from the old ways of being that I'd had under those same sets of conditions that I'd been in. So watch how conditions affect your sense of who you are. So the second thing to look at is to look at our views. So to ask ourselves, so how is my sense of self, how is my sense of who I am affected, fixed, and limited by the views that I hold about myself? So we're really defined by our views. We're defined by our views. We're defined by our preferences. We're defined by our opinions. And we can go through life being really unclear about these things. But it's really important that if we're going to understand how it is that our sense of who we are isn't perhaps as fixed and defined as we think it is, it's really important to look at these views. So look at how these views condition our sense of self, because they then go on to condition how we behave. And then we behave in a particular way, and that behaviour then reinforces the view, which then reinforces our sense of who we are. So we get stuck. I'm thinking back to right at the beginning of the introductory course where we talk about those, cycles of behaviour. And views play a really important part in that. So I was thinking of lots of different views that I held, but I'm just going to go on a completely different tangent now, because I had a bit of a mishap when I was writing this talk. I wrote it last weekend, and I came to print it out this morning, hadn't looked at it for a whole week, and my computer wouldn't turn on, so I couldn't get my talk. And all of a sudden, I just had a huge panic and thought, I cannot give this talk without my notes. I can't do it. And got into a real flap about it. Thought, what am I going to do? I'm going to have to say, I can't do it, all these sorts of things. And then I thought, well, just a minute, think about what your talk was actually about. So maybe this is a view that is fixing and limiting my sense of who I am and what I can do. So it's really important that we look for the times when we're holding these really strong views and seeing how they are channeling us into having a particular fixed view of who we are and what we're capable of. I just had to kind of jot down what I could remember, but yet here I am giving a talk. And so this leads me on to the third point that I wanted to make about things that we can look at. So look at the cracks in your experience. And what I mean by that is times when our experience of the world doesn't match up with our views about ourselves. And if we look hard enough, these cracks are all over the place. But we're so used to relating to ourselves through such a habitual stuck pattern of views in a stuck set of conditions that we don't notice them. And that's where I was earlier this morning. I needed to see the possibility of that crack in my experience. So I have this view, I cannot give a talk unless I have a really clear set of notes. And yet, I'm here and I'm giving a talk. So, in a way, things didn't work out how I wanted to. The lectioners are there. My computer breaking is a lesson in impermanence. It is also a lesson in dukkha, in unsatisfactoriness. But it's also a lesson in anatman, in a lack of fit self, because I've been able to see how I can transcend strong views that I might have in a particular situation. So in a way, this talk has kind of ended up being unwritten, or at least not written in the way that I wanted it to be. But actually, I was thinking, just as I came up the stairs, that is like a perfect metaphor for us. You know, we are unwritten, or we're not written in the ways that we want to be. You know, that is a metaphor for life, and it's a metaphor for our future. So we don't know how our future lives are going to end up being written, who we are going to end up being in the future. And it just strikes me that what Anatman is talking about is that we have a choice. We have a choice that we can continue to allow our lives to be written for us, written by those same old sets of conditions, those same views that we find ourselves stuck in and unexamined. Or we can see that actually, this lack of inherent fixedness of me and who I am can be something expansive and wonderful and new and brilliant if we just let that be a possibility. You know, I'm about to, in 8 weeks' time, I'm going to be going on a 4-month ordination retreat, and I have no idea who I am going to be when I get back at the end of that. And that is wonderful. And even though you might not be having that same sort of experience, the same is also going to be true for all of you. Who are you going to be in 4 months' time? And are you going to allow yourself to be written with the same old scripts that we've been going through our whole lives? Or is there a possibility for something new, something expansive, something different? So, yes, and that man, every day is important.
Hi. Can you, is my mic working? Good. It's a bit of a weird one, isn't it? Having a favourite lectioner and deciding to choose dukkha. I'm not sure favourite is really a word I would apply to it. But actually, it was something I actively chose. I really wanted to look at dukkha, and I think it was because I wanted to just examine it and understand its effect on me, or how I relate to it better. So, yeah. So hopefully I've done a bit of that work. So last week, I just want to come back to last week, and last week Bodhinaga started by his talk by telling us that wisdom protects us. And as we heard earlier, Manjushri is one of the three protectors, and his wisdom is a protective force. So I was just thinking, well, how amazing would it be if we really could see the Lakshanas, really see them as describing the way life is, you know, and how that would be protective for us. And if we could really see the world in that way, we'd be living more in line with reality, and we'd be less likely to suffer unnecessarily. We'd be less likely to spend time regretting the past or living in the future about, you know, thinking about this perfect time in the future, which probably isn't going to happen. So that's kind of where I started with thinking about dukkha and thinking about, you know, how it could be protective, the wisdom of understanding it. So as part of my preparation for the talk, I listened to several talks about dukkha on Free Buddhist Audio. And from those I heard the following things. From listening to a talk by Maitreya Bandhu, he said, well, dukkha's only really useful insofar as it makes us think. So that's interesting, isn't it? It makes us think. And then from Maitreyi, dukkha can be useful because it connects us with others through empathy and through compassion. So it makes us think, and perhaps it connects us with compassion to others. And of course the Buddha started with dukkha, didn't he? That was his first teaching, the first noble truth. That we suffer. We suffer because we crave. We crave for things to be different, and we're not accepting them as they truly are. And then lastly, from Bhante says, dukkha is the way off the wheel. It's the way off the wheel of life. It's the way off our cyclical existence, and it's the first step on the spiral path. So there's something about dukkha that's, you know, it's great if we can kind of understand it a bit better. So I started thinking about this talk at the beginning of January, and I was thinking, actually, January in England is a really good time to be thinking about dukkha. It's cold, it's wet, it's snowing, it's icy, it's miserable. Dark, and if you live on the top of Crooks like I do, it's also really windy, so you walk out of the door and get blown over. It's worth remembering that these January days, life can be really bumpy, and I really love that image of dukkha being like the ill-fitting chariot wheel. You know, life gives us a bumpy ride sometimes. Somehow we expect it not to, you know, and we're fed up when it does. So I also want to go back to a few weeks ago, Satyajyoti, when she was introducing us to the Lakshanas, talked about many different lists of the different types of dukkha. And one of them lists 8 different types of dukkha. The first 4 are birth, sickness, aging, and death. And I'm not going to actually go to those places very much. I'm not going to talk about them. But the next 4 come in 2 pairs. So the first pair is being separated from those we love and being forced to endure the company of those we don't love. That's one pair. And then the next pair is not getting what we want, but also getting what we don't want. So mainly, I've been looking at my experience over the last month in terms of those pairs. So sometimes I think we have what I call a real dukkha day. You know those days when, for whatever reasons, things don't go right. So the car breaks down, you get a puncture or whatever. So I'm not quite sure what's been happening, but this January I seem to be having a series of dukkha days, and they all seem to be on a Wednesday for some reason. I don't know why. But Yeah, so a few weeks ago I had a real kind of dookery day. So on Wednesday I usually start the day by driving my daughter to college, and yeah, I'm lucky to work part-time, so after that I come home and do some chores and then I go to work in the afternoon. So this particular Wednesday started with two things for me. First, I was in a really positive frame of mind, like, you know, really good, great, good day. Even though it was heavy snow outside, so it was chucking it down, snowing really heavily. So luckily my daughter only had one class at college and the snow was quite deep, so we decided to abandon the idea of college. We weren't going out in the snow. So that was great. It was great for me because suddenly I had this spacious morning. I didn't have to trek across town and come back again. So that was good. I meditated, did my yoga practice. Fantastic. Headed downstairs to the kitchen, and big puddle of water on the kitchen. Somebody had left the freezer door open. So I was like, oh, great, okay. So most of the freezer was defrosted, had to, you know, and it was all kind of frosted over and it all needed sorted out, all food taken out. So, okay. So I was like, oh, you know. I cleaned it up, salvaged what I could of the food, managed not to get too caught up with thoughts of, and who left the bleeding door open? You know, could have been me, could have been my daughter. Let it go. Yeah, so that was good. I carried on, did my housework, prepared a salad for lunch, and I was feeling really good about this salad because I had a bit for today and I had a bit for tomorrow as well, so I was really ahead of the game. And then managed to throw it all over the floor. So for the second time that morning, I was cleaning the kitchen floor, thinking, what is going on here? This is my Wednesday spacious morning, you know? Okay, so, well, you know, move on, clean it up, move on. I still had today's lunch, that was okay. And actually, by that time, it was a really beautiful sunny day. So I put my big coat on, put my boots on, and walked to work. And it was a fabulous day. You know, from the top of Crooks, I could see over the city, and the snow was doing that amazing thing of just being impermanence and insubstantiality in action. So it was melting and forming these rivers down the hill. It was lovely. Except, do you ever have that thing where your coat's pocket, it's got a zip on it and the zip gets caught? So the zip got caught at the top of the pocket, so I couldn't get my glove out. So I was like, so that was, and then halfway down the hill, my boots started leaking. So then I had a wet sock as well. So it's just, you know, dukkha was arising. Things were unsatisfactory. They were small things, and actually I was in a good mood. And it was almost quite amusing because it was giving me some good material for my tour. So I was like, okay, you know, this is life, this is what happens. So I guess this is an example of quite straightforward dukkha. It was unsatisfactory. I kind of moved on. I wasn't getting what I wanted, and I had to put up with quite a lot of what I didn't want. But although that was a bit irritating, I just moved on. I didn't start thinking gloomy thoughts. I didn't start going, oh, why does this always happen to me? And thank you. And I didn't take it personally. I didn't get hung up about it. Another thought that was also protective for me was that I often repeat one of the four reminders by Tsongkhapa, and that is, however I act, life always has difficulties. No one can control it all. And I find that very comforting, you know, that I can't control the world, I can't control. These are just conditions that are playing out, it happens. and then I have a choice as to whether I get very upset about it or I just move on. So, interestingly, I had another dukkha day last Wednesday. And on this particular day, it was pouring with rain first thing in the morning. And I hadn't slept well. But I was up early and I was ready to take my daughter to college. But unfortunately, she was not up early. And she was definitely not in a good mood. So, I'm not sure why, but it was kind of one of those really bad moods where you have to take it out on someone else. And it was going to be me that she was taking it out on. So somehow everything was wrong. We were late, she didn't have the right outfit. That was probably my fault because I hadn't washed it or something. She forgot her textbook, she forgot her packed lunch, her umbrella, and then I didn't have any money to give her her lunch money. So, and this sort of litany of misery continued for most of the car drive. And the car journey just seemed to go on forever because the traffic was terrible because of the torrential rain. So anyway, I'm afraid after a while, I did take the bait and I joined in and we ended up having a rather familiar argument. Anyway, it was painful, it was really horrible, and I dropped her off and I felt really shaken and upset for the rest of the day. Where was my beautiful, witty daughter who I love? And why was I being forced to spend time locked in this car with a critical, miserable, negative teenager who I definitely don't love? So, it was upsetting. And it was reverberating around my brain the next morning when I was meditating. But suddenly I woke up and I found myself locked. Yeah, I found myself locked in this miserable, familiar train of thought, which involved thoughts of how unfair my daughter was, how she didn't appreciate me, and it went as far as thinking, how I wanted to punish her for being mean to me, But luckily I managed to catch it and catch hold of the prapancha and look at it, and it was suddenly really clear to me, the argument was painful, but what was I doing now? I was just stabbing another second arrow into my heart and twisting it around, It was painful seeing that, but it was really good to see that because then I could manage to let it go and connect with my fears that, I was worried that my daughter didn't like me and that she was going to leave home and we wouldn't be close, and that was really painful for me. And I was worried that she was going to leave college and not manage to get her A-levels. So I was able to connect with compassion for myself with all my worries and anxieties, but also my compassion for her. Because after all, it's really rubbish to wake up late on a day when it's pouring with rain and you forget your lunch and your textbooks. So I was able to then feel more kindly towards her. So, on this day I didn't succeed so well in being resilient to the dukkha that was arising. Firstly, I took the argument bait and reacted to my daughter's bad mood. And then secondly, I carried on, throughout the day and the next day. But fortunately, I was aware enough in meditation to recognise what I was doing. And interestingly, that very night, it was parents' evening at my daughter's college, and I had the experience of seeing how my daughter changes enormously from one situation to another. So her teachers were all incredibly positive about her. They think she's a lovely girl, she's doing really well, she's kind to her classmates, and she's up to date with her work. So my own daughter is subject to the laws of impermanence and insubstantiality there before my eyes. So I hope I've illustrated how wisdom can protect us. If we experience dukkha, if we can really think about it, and we can recognise what it for what it is and not take it so personally, maybe we can see through it and not get so thrown about by it, not be so reactive. And maybe that can hopefully open us up to compassion for both ourselves and for others as well.